WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. For years, scientists have been pondering the question, what happened right after the Big Bang that caused the universe to get so big so fast? Last week, a team of astronomers who have been using a high-powered telescope in the South Pole believe they have found the answer. They have been looking across 13.8 billion years to the beginning of time and what happened in that trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. They were able to detect something called gravitational waves. Today, we want to learn more about why this find is so exciting, how it fits into our understanding of the universe, how it was born, how it works, and where it is going. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Mark Devlin is the Reese W. Flower Professor of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Pennsylvania. And Mark Devlin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
And another Mark, Mark Trodden, is with us as well. He's the Fay R. and Eugene L. Langberg Professor of Physics, also co-director of the Center for Particle Cosmology at the University of Pennsylvania. And Mark Trodden, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
So Mark Trodden, how big a deal is this?
Well, if the measurements hold up and new measurements confirm them, and the origin of these gravitational waves that have been discovered is the origin that we think they are, I would say it's at least as big a discovery as any other scientific discovery in the last 100 years. This would be the smoking gun that tells us that, for example, gravity itself is a quantum mechanical phenomenon. It's something that behaves like our theories of elementary particles, like the atom does. And it would also provide us with insights into the earliest times in the universe, as I think we'll discuss at some length. So it would be a very big deal indeed.
Is it a big deal from your perspective, Mark?
It certainly is. I mean, we were waiting for this for the last 15 or 20 years. People have been thinking about looking for this, and we were expecting to have to wait another 15 years or so before we would get the answer. So it's came as quite a surprise to see this a little bit early in the whole process.
Mark Trodden, you had a number of ifs, if, and that, of course, is very important in science, right, to be able to reproduce these results?
That's right. I mean, we don't really... Results like this we tend to think of as provisional, no matter how careful or expert the people who do them are, until we have further data, better measurements, other independent groups that do the same thing. And the wonderful situation in cosmology these days, I think, which you know Mark can tell you much more about, is that we're at a time when there are many more experiments like this out there. So we will get this data, and we'll know more about it soon.
Help us understand this telescope that they've been using. It's called BICEP 2.
That's right. It's a telescope that's, well, obviously there was a BICEP 1.
Yes,
and now
I figured.
And now there's a BICEP 2, and the next generation is called the Keck telescope because the Keck people paid for it. But it's essentially it doesn't look like a telescope like you're expecting with big mirrors and so forth. It is a big can, essentially, that cools the detectors down to just above absolute zero, and it has a bunch of lenses. So it's more like a camera lens than you would expect to look for a real telescope, you know, that you see on Discovery Channel or something like that. And it's basically got a whole bunch of detectors in it, and people talk about on their cell phones, you have a megapixel camera. Well, this is a 500-pixel camera, so in that sense, it's not impressive in numbers. It's what it's impressive is in the sensitivity that you get. And, for example, if you want to take a picture with your camera and there's not very much light, you have to open the shutter for a very long time. In this case, you have to open the shutter for years and you know, basically integrate and take data for a very long time to basically what we call beat down the noise that's inherent in the measurement. So it's a very, very careful experiment over a very long period of time. That being said, we were expecting the number to be 10 times lower than this, and so this is not a subtle effect that they're seeing here, and so it will be something that people can go after pretty easily, and easily as a quote unquote, it's not that hard, not that easy, but it's something that we've been preparing to do a much more careful job on, and I think we'll nail it.
And what specifically have they been looking for, Mark Trodden?
So what they're looking for, they're looking back across the universe, as you said, at light that comes from the very early times in the universe. This is the thing that's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. When the universe was younger, it was hotter, and it glowed, much as you know the elements on your stovetop might glow when they're heated. And as it glows, it gives off radiation. And that radiation, for most of the history of the universe, just streams through the universe until eventually we happen to build a good enough detector that can absorb it. Now, you know, that light is, you know, there are many features of it that are interesting to us, but one thing that's interesting is whether it's what's called polarized. So what that really just means is that light's constructed of electric and magnetic fields that are vibrating, and the polarization is just it vibrating one way rather than another way. And they're looking for patterns of this polarization in the light, and the reason that's important is that those patterns can be particular patterns, can be traced back to squeezing of space that would have happened at very early times in the universe due to these gravitational waves. So they're looking at light, but they're interpreting it as the gravitational waves that the light was experiencing as it was released.
And is that what they found?
That's what they claim to find. They find this polarization pattern that's of a particular kind, and there are a couple of other ways you can get such a pattern in the universe that are more mundane, at least to my eyes, although people put a lot of work into measuring those things. But they believe that they understand those things and can subtract them off. And what's left, they think, is what we would call primordial, from the very, very beginnings of this thing we call the inflationary stage.
And when I talked about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, I don't even know what that means, but that's how it's described.
But it's about right.
That's is it about right?
That's about the right.
How are we supposed to understand that, though?
It's hard.
I mean, is it a mathematical formula, or it's,
oh no,
it's just time.
It's time. I mean, literally, you start counting from t equals zero, if you'd like. Although we really can't talk about t equals zero because it's too small, but we can start talking just after that, and that's what Mark was talking about, is when the universe is behaving quantum mechanically, and so the universe is behaving quantum mechanically before this period we call inflation, and then an inflation takes those quantum mechanical, if you like, fluctuations and expands them by a great deal very, very quickly. And those features get then imprinted into the universe, and they can't really change until very, very late in the whole process. So one thing that's important to realize is that when we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're looking at the universe when it was about 380,000 years old. And you can only really talk about stuff happening inside that small sphere of influence. These gravity waves actually are occurring on much larger scales than that, which really points to them having to have been created in the first instance. They couldn't have been created afterwards and then have the same patterns over such a large scale.
And when we talk about patterns, we think about patterns as design or twisting shapes. Is that, to you, Mark Cron, is that how we should think about this?
I mean, there's a when you look at this radiation I mentioned on the sky, what you're really looking at is a temperature map of this radiation. So when you look at that, if you're looking from place to place, one remarkable feature of the universe, which I think still is stunning to all of us, is how uniform that temperature is. You look in many different directions, the temperature is essentially the same. What's amazing is that if you look very, very carefully, and this only really started to be done 25 years or so ago, a little bit more, you notice that it's not exactly the same. It's slightly different from place to place. And those differences in temperature can directly be traced back to the tiny differences in matter and density of matter at early times in the universe that eventually grew into the galaxies and clusters of galaxies that we see today, the things we call structure in the universe. So that's one pattern you see. But superposed on top of that is not just the temperature differences of the light that's coming towards you, but also this polarization pattern, this sort of swirling or bending of the directions of the vibrations of electric and magnetic fields. And those are the patterns that they found. And so it is indeed a very visual thing. Once you map the way these directions look on the sky, it is a beautiful swirling pattern indeed that you see.
And why the South Pole? I know you have done work there, Mark Devlin. Why is that such a good place to look back in time?
Well, I work in Antarctica flying balloons on the coast for a different kind of science. Although I've been to the South Pole for a little visit, but the wavelength of the light that this the cosmic microwave background works at it happens at about a millimeter. So it's very, very long compared to visible light. And so where you can look up in the night sky, and if it's clear out, you can see a star. Mm-hmm. If I were to look up with one of my telescopes, it would look completely black. In other words, you can't see through it. And that happens because of oxygen and water, both of which we like for us, but are very bad for my experiment. So the South Pole is relatively high. It's got a pressure altitude of about 14,000 feet, but it's also very, very dry. It's basically a desert. And so that gives you the observing conditions that you can look through it mostly. I mean, you'd like to be in space, but space is expensive, and so South Pole is a little cheaper.
Oh, wow. And just literally, you can see more from the South Pole?
You can see clearer. So it's like a cloudy day versus a clear day, and there it's a clear day most of the time.
And I was reading that there's low air pressure down there as
well.
Yeah,
it's at 14,000 feet. So it's relatively low. That's, it's about two-thirds of the air pressure that we have here.
And I was reading that reduces the noises from the atmosphere.
Yes, it does.
It does.
Yeah, so it's a very important thing. Now, there are other experiments that are in, like, Chile, for example, that are at 17,000 feet and have access to different parts of the sky and so forth. So there's lots of different places you can do this. The South Pole just happens to be one of them.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
What's amazing to me as I'm a theoretical physicist, so I will not be going to the South Pole at all.
You'll be in your lab somewhere,
right? I'll be sitting in a coffee shop somewhere, but I'm glad some people go there. but what's always amazing to me as someone who doesn't go there is my picture of the South Pole is that it's wet.
Yes.
But I guess a big deal for observers is that it's not wet, right. That it's incredibly dry.
It's mostly cold and flat and white.
And all of that is good for the kind of
everything's
this kind
good.
Of science
I mean,
that we're talking
example,
about.
For example, the fact that it's flat means the turbulence of the air above the telescope is reduced. The fact that it's cold means it's very dry. Flat is kind of good too, but it's not as big a deal.
Well, we are talking about a discovery, a find. The big news is about the Big Bang, and again, talking with Mark Devlin and Mark Trodden about what has been discovered and whether it's reproducible and what it all means. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. Going back to you, Mark Trodden, I mean, how long would it take, you think, to reproduce the results that we've been talking about? I mean, this happened quicker, I think, than most people predicted.
Well, I'm probably not the right person in the two of us to answer that
okay.
question. There will be, I know there will be data coming out later this year, I think, from the Planck satellite, which is an experiment from Europe, which had given us the first sort of real constraints on this, well, maybe not the first, but real constraints on this already. And it'll be interesting to see what they have to say. But there are experiments that are designed to look for polarization. And I think Mark is probably the right person to tell you about the path of those.
Yes.
Ahead,
so the Planck satellite is an all sky satellite. In other words, where the BICEP team measured about 400 square degrees, which is about two of your hands covering the sky held at arm's length. So if you just put that out there, that's about how much they covered. Planck covers the entire sky, but it's not nearly as sensitive, and that means that they won't be able to come close to the measurement that the BICEP guys have done. However, they will put a limit at one aspect of it, and that I think we would probably see within the next 6 months.
Oh, really?
And,
that's soon.
Yeah, and if it's a year, I wouldn't be too surprised. But 6 months is the number that they're passing around now. Then there are there's a handful of experiments, about a half a dozen experiments, which are on deck for doing this. And again, they were shooting for a number which was much smaller than this, and so. If they work at all, they should see this effect. One of the things to keep in mind is that there's the believability aspect of this, and we're working on designing experiments that will check to make sure that all these things are in order and that it works right.
I'm going to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Mark Devlin, who joined us along with Mark Trodden, and we're talking about the big news about the Big Bang, and the phones have exploded, as they always do when we talk about stuff like this. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans for 20 years. This year's show takes place at the 23rd Street Armory just north of Chestnut Street and runs from Friday evening, April 4th to Sunday the 6th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. Info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
No matter where you live, no matter how you spend your day, the experiences you have listening to Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, become a part of your life. Our correspondents circle the globe, meet people you'd never otherwise meet, and introduce them to you. It's like you're traveling with us. Come along on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, if you were a crayon, what color would you be and why? That's an actual question being asked in job interviews right now as employers become pickier than ever. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about last week's news, scientists announcing that they believe they have evidence supporting a theory called cosmic inflation, which could explain the universe's rapid expansion in less than a trillionth of a second. We're talking about why this find is so exciting, potentially Earth-changing or perhaps universe-changing, how it fits into our understanding of how the universe was born and what questions remain. And again, our guests are Mark Trodden, who's a professor of physics at the University of Pennsylvania, also co-director of the Center for Particle Cosmology at Penn. Also with us, Mark Devlin. He's a professor of astronomy and astrophysics, also at the University of Pennsylvania. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We might have gone over this earlier, but we had some email questions, even Facebook questions, actually, before the show began. One of them from Laura asking, so what is cosmic inflation? I think we talked about it a little bit, but Mark Trodden, all fingers point to you. Go ahead.
Well, so the universe today is very big, as we usually know, and we also know that it's expanding. It's getting bigger. And if you trace that back in time, you know that it was smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's tracing that story back that leads us to most of the great successes of cosmology. It predicts the Big Bang, the cosmic radiation. It predicts the way in which the light elements formed, a number of other things. But one thing you find when you trace this time back is that at very early times, two things happen. One, you're faced with a number of questions that you just don't know how to answer in the normal way of thinking about cosmology. Questions like, why does the universe, when you look in different directions, look very much the same? Because you would expect it to be sort of randomly clumpy in different directions. And questions to do with the fact, as we mentioned, that when you look on the sky today, you see galaxies and clusters. They grew through gravitational attraction. So at early times, they should have been little bits of matter, more here, more there. What laid down, what decided how much more matter where to lead to the structure we have today? And in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, people realized that there was a sort of mind-blowing possible explanation for all these features. And the idea was that instead of undergoing its usual slow expansion, we normally think about the universe, with the exception of its very recent history, as expanding, getting bigger in time, but slowing down.
Right.
Because all the stuff in it's attracting one another. But the idea here was, instead of that, maybe it expanded incredibly quickly. And that incredible expansion does a lot of things for you. First of all, it makes the universe very similar everywhere. And the reason is that a little patch that might normally be much smaller than you would ever imagine and fairly the same, just because it had time to sort of, as we'd say, thermalize, would be blown out to a size much bigger than the size of our observable universe. Those numbers are so ridiculous that there's no point using them on air.
I don't even know how to think
about
that.
But bigger than our observable universe. The other thing is, which I think is even more amazing, is that while that's happening, we know from our theories of particle physics that quantum mechanics, the theory of the tiny, the theory of things that work inside the atom, causes all matter, but also space and time itself, we think, to jiggle around. Mm. This happens all the time in the world, but we think of it as being something that's fundamentally subatomic in nature. But if this happens while the universe is blowing up incredibly quickly in size, then those quantum fluctuations can be made huge. And so that does two things for you, it turns out. One is, at the end of inflation, when this expansion stops and the normal Big Bang expansion takes over, you're left with little bits of jitter from place to place, a little bit more density here than there. And guess what? Those are the things that grow later on to make the clusters of galaxies and things like that. And that's been, you know, mapped out of the last 20 years or so. But more amazingly is the prediction that gravity itself would have been quantum jittering. And, you know, it's easy to say those words, but for me that's amazing, because we have no measurement in the history of science that shows that gravity has a quantum nature. And yet, this is a prediction. And if that's true, then you should see polarized gravitational waves on the sky in a certain way. And that's what's being claimed to be observed.
Anything you want to add to that from your perspective, Mark Devlin?
Well, I think that the idea that inflation was predicted, or at least came up about, with these basic observations of the universe. And so when people went and looked in the sky, they measured the cosmic microwave background to reasonable precision, and they said, well, you know, it's the same over there as over there, but this patch I'm looking at to the left is 13.7 billion years over that way, and the patch on the right is 13.7 billion years over that way, and these patches could never have known each other.
Right.
They never knew. It's like basically going to a football game, and everybody is wearing a red T-shirt, not just the same red T-shirt, not just the same red, it's the same shade. Everything's exactly the same. And without having like a phone call to tell everybody to wear that shirt, and because it's impossible for them to have communicated that information. The only way to have that happen is if at some point they all knew about each other, they were all in the same spot to communicate that information, and that means the universe had to have been incredibly small at one point and then inflated beyond that to take them away from each other very quickly. And that is the one thing that I find is the best description of inflation. It really solves that problem. Now, it sounds contrived, right? And so when you contrive something like that, you've got to make predictions, and that's what scientists do. So some crazy theorist, no offense, Mark, comes up with a theory,
right?
And everybody says, well, I don't know. What can you tell me that I can measure that will prove this theory and prove that you're right? And then they say, oh, well, if it's true, this quantum mechanical fluctuation that Mark was talking about should be imprinted on the sky that we see. And then they make a series of calculations and say, well, this is how big I think it should be, and so forth. And then they pass it on to people like me, and we say, okay, well, if it's that small, I'm gonna have to go and build this kind of telescope with this kind of sensitivity and look for this long to be able to measure it with any confidence. And then we measure it, and if it matches the prediction, it's a pretty good deal, and we like that. And that worked out really, really well for the cosmic microwave background in general, because they made very strong predictions of what that would do. And that was solved about a little over a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And then people moved on to the much harder problem, which is the gravity waves.
And that's what we've been talking about. Do you think Einstein, Mark Trodden, would be surprised by last week's announcement?
I don't think that he'd be surprised at the existence of gravitational waves. I think he might be very surprised by the fact that their origin is quantum mechanical. Yeah, but I'd like to add also to what Mark said, that it is worth pointing out that we were discussing inflation, and a lot of the media coverage and the excitement is about inflation. And personally, I'm very excited about the possibility of this being inflationary in origin. But it is worth adding a cautionary note. We had a lot of ifs at the beginning of the show about the data. But there are ifs about the theory, too. We should, there's two parts to interpreting this the way we do. One is that the data be solid. The other is that our interpretation fit the data well and be a compelling theoretical explanation for it. And I think, there's work to do on both those. This is strong supporting evidence for inflation. We should feel really excited about that. But we should also be cautious, and we should push at the theory and push at alternatives to the theory to see if we can narrow it down as the unique explanation for what's being observed.
Let me get some callers into the conversation, talking with Mark Trodden and Mark Devlin. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Dylan from Milford to join our conversation. Hi, Dylan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I was wondering, how does this discovery change our understanding of the universe?
A very simple question, right? Mark Devlin, I'm looking at you. Does it?
Well,
it's
not going to change your everyday life. Let me put it that way.
Okay.
But I do think it, as Mark was pointing out, is that we have a bunch of we'd like to basically understand the universe that we live in, and we'd like to, close the loop, tie the knot, put a bow on, and say we really understand
right.
this. And this is a really big, important step that says, okay, wow, this really is right, and we need to modify it a little bit, but in general, we're in the right direction. And I think that that's really the important thing. I should point out that this measurement is on the very high side, very, very high side of what was expected. In fact, it's higher than what was expected, basically. And it does put a lot of stress on the basic inflationary model. And people are already, I'm sure there's a dozen or two dozen papers already been posted in the last week, which try to make this measurement work inside the current model.
Go ahead, Mark Trodden.
So there are a couple of things I could add to that about how it changes your picture of the universe. One is that, one way to think about our telescopes and doing astronomy is as time machines. They take you back in time. You watch as light comes across the universe to you. And before this announcement on Monday, the earliest direct evidence that we measure from the universe is from what's called the abundances of the light elements that were made in the Big Bang. And that evidence comes from somewhere in the region of a second to a minute after the Big Bang. And so one way this changes our view of the universe is this pushes back our direct observation of the universe back to 10 to the minus 35 seconds, or a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. So that should be stunning to you. And the other thing to say is that another way to think about the way we use our telescopes is not as a time machine so much as a microscope. It allows us to see higher and higher energies because we look back in time further away. The universe was younger and hotter, and the particles in it were much more energetic. And so we build wonderful experiments on Earth, like the Large Hadron Collider, to measure high energies. And the great virtue of doing that is that we can do repeatable precision experiments with those colliders. But to put that in perspective, the physics that we think might have been responsible for this signal is from an energy that is
trillion.
Is it a trillion?
Yeah,
a trillion times higher in energy than you can measure at the Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, my goodness.
So that allows you to use this as a microscope to look inside the atom and at physics at energy scales and length scales that we could never imagine really accessing on Earth. So I think it changes your picture a lot.
Does it tell us anything about other universes? Is there a connection there, or is that just one of those silly questions that gets asked under these circumstances?
I have lots of friends who would love to answer that question for you, but I'm not one of them.
Okay. Are you one of his friends who
could
do that?
It's a good question. People are definitely discussing this question. So inflation, one consequence of some inflation models, and I should say I consider this to be somewhat speculative, but certainly people talk about it and it's a respectable thing to work on, is that when inflation ends in certain parts of the universe and gives rise to our universe that we see, in other parts it does not end and continues inflating. And this is an idea that's called eternal inflation. And if that's true, then indeed you do expect universes to be spawned all over the place. And in recent years, this idea has seen something of a resurgence because it's been realized that if a certain part of our understanding of string theory is correct, this theory of unifying quantum mechanics and gravity, then you might find a natural way to have this idea of eternal inflation in string theory. So it might add weight to that, but I think there are a lot of theoretical ifs, the ones I talked about there in the way. Do we have a theory of quantum gravity that works? Can we really make these sort of somewhat large theoretical leaps to say that eternal inflation happens? Those things are not clear yet, but it adds a little weight to the story. If you want to have eternal inflation, you better know inflation's right first.
Let me see if this is in your bailiwick. Mark Devlin, is it possible to look right before the Big Bang?
Yeah, I get that question a lot.
Yeah, I feel like my ignorance is completely on display here.
I've been to talks where people talk about what it looks like before that period, but it's really not possible for us to look at those timescales because it just there's no information there. So once you enter this,
there's nothing.
I didn't say that. I just said it's not possible for us to know what's there. Once you enter this era, which is called the Planck era, where things are so small, then momentum and energy are changed or interchangeable, and it just wipes out all information from before that. So you're really not in a position to do that.
Right.
Another thing I think that what Mark was talking about is that you have this idea that inflation can be taking place all the time all over the place. And you wonder, well, why can't we observe all those things? Mm-hmm. And you have to then understand multi-dimensions and so forth and to realize that, they're just things we can't observe. And the idea that if the universe hadn't come out the way it is, then you might ask the question, well, could we be here to ask the question whether or not it should have come out the way it is? Mm-hmm. And so that's a little bit circular, but it in fact is true because the conditions are set that produce the elements and the physical parameters which make up our universe, they're set in these eras, this grand unification era, which happens again around this time period. And if it hadn't happened that way, then gravity wouldn't work the same way, and we might not be here to talk about it.
Let me get Joe from Abington to join our conversation. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thank you for allowing me to ask a question.
Just to
get back to this this idea of this multiverse theory. I mean, I have heard that the existence of gravity waves and inflation leads to the potential for this idea of multiverses. And I guess my question is, how could one possibly prove something like that? I mean, it seems like a kind of a fantastical type of idea,
sure.
but impossible to actually prove.
Well, do you agree with that, Mark Trotten?
I think the way you said it is essentially correct. I think that if this is evidence for inflation, then the way I described earlier, it adds weight to the idea that you might have this thing called eternal inflation. And if that's true, then you probably do have a multiverse. Then your question is, how do I test that? And the answer is, I have no idea, and no one else does at this point. So I think right now the thing you might hope for would be that we would have a very compelling theoretical framework. Perhaps that would be string theory, who knows. And that you would test many, many, many things about that theory and increase your confidence that it's correct. And you would also find that an unavoidable consequence of that theory was also that you get eternal inflation and multiverses. And you might say, well, so what? If I can't measure them, so what? Well, that's true. I think that might be the right attitude. It'd just be we don't know. But it is also true, as Mark pointed out, that one possible consequence of that is that some features of our universe might be explained just by the fact that we're one among many and we happen to be that way. I'm not telling you to believe that. I'm telling you some people are working on it, and we should work really hard and see what happens.
Joe, thanks for the call. Did you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, back in the day when the WMAP satellite first put its results out, there were people who would go look for patterns in the sky on very large scales, which would indicate that there was an adjacent universe which is impinging on ours. And actually, they never found any. They thought they found one once, right. But then didn't see anything.
So what comes after BICEP 2? I mean, then we're talking about what BICEP 2 has been able to observe.
Right.
Is there something in the works that would take us to whatever that next level is of observation?
There's a whole bunch of people working on this problem. First of all, the BICEP team has morphed into the Keck team, and they have a much more powerful instrument which they're going to be using. And they hinted at that data in their most recent paper on last Monday. But that hasn't produced their data yet. But there are at least two high altitude balloon experiments which are designed to do this with very high sensitivity. One of them called SPIDER will be flying in December. There's an experiment in Chile called Polar Bear, which is also going to be doing this, but they use a completely different method for making it happen. There's an experiment called the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which I happen to be on, which is gearing up to do this measurement as well.
Wow.
And I expect that, again, since the signal is 10 times bigger than we thought it was, it shouldn't be very long before somebody says, okay, this is right. But it's not as simple as making one measurement. You really have to make a bunch of measurements to really nail this down.
And I've seen some video of some of the balloon experiments that you've been doing, and I'm assuming it allows you to go up and
right.
Out,
I mean, there's a lot of advantages from a balloon. I mean, one is that when you're on the ground, you still have to deal with a lot of atmosphere, and that is the primary source of noise in these experiments. And we call it like the background, and it's a lot of background noise. And when you go above the atmosphere in a high altitude balloon, you get rid of most of the background, and so you can take the data much faster. So you don't have to. Whereas they were 2 years, you might only need 2 weeks on a balloon, or 4 weeks on a balloon to make the same measurement. So that's it's a fantastic advantage. The disadvantage is if it breaks, you can't go out there with a screwdriver and fix it, right? Because it's on a balloon, and when it comes down, it might break again, and you can't fly it again. So it's plus and minus. But the important part here is it's a different experiment, and what we call since this is such a small signal, we're subject to what's called systematic problems, and systematics are things which can induce a signal that you weren't expecting, and a balloon experiment would give you a different set of those.
And that's Mark Devlin, who joins us along with Mark Trodden. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499, and email radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Walnut Street Theater, presenting Arsenic and Old Lace, Broadway's classic comedy. Mortimer Brewster is worried that his lovely fiancée won't understand his unusual family. Abby and Martha Brewster are known for their acts of kindness and charity, but Mortimer has learned that his charming spinster aunts have taken to relieving the loneliness of old men by inviting them in for a nice glass of elderberry wine, laced with arsenic and just a pinch of cyanide. March 11th through April 27th. Details at walnutstreettheater.org, Ticketmaster, or 215-574-3550.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
Does a mission to preserve and increase the value of shares get in the way of a mission to preserve and increase the value of the environment?
I came into BP right out of business school, really idealistic, but the day-to-day is pretty small.
Lessons about corporate ethics learned while at BP. That's the conversation next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Last week, researchers announced that some evidence that supports the theory of cosmic inflation about the rapid expansion of the universe at the beginning of time and space. We're talking about this with our guest, Mark Devlin, again, a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Pennsylvania, and Mark Trodden, who is the director of the Center for Particle Cosmology at Penn, also a professor of physics, and lots of phone calls, lots of questions. And including one, an email we have from Robert. We constantly hear the universe is expanding, but expanding into what? And I actually asked both of you this during the break, and you had a very interesting explanation. Do you want to take that, Mark Devlin?
So the idea of the Big Bang, the name actually was kind of a mocking of what was happening about 100 years ago when Hubble had measure the universe was in fact expanding, and they said, well, if the universe is expanding, then back in time it must have been coming from a point and really high energy, and that sounds like starting a Big Bang.
Yes.
And it was meant to say, this is crazy, you're out of your mind, you must have done something wrong, much like people are probably saying about this measurement. So right. No, that's not true. So but the idea that space is expanding into something is a problem, because you may be picturing the Big Bang as something where you're looking from the outside and watching this point and going boom, and it's like an explosion, and that's absolutely not what's happening. What's happening is space itself is expanding in a very short period of time, and we're expanding space, we're not expanding into some existing space.
Let me get, looks like Bill from Wayne to join our conversation. Hi, Bill, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking the call. This is a great discussion.
Thanks.
Again, my question talks about internal inflation. I guess the question is, at the very instant of expansion, when the universe itself was expanding faster than the speed of light, would we still see expansion at those speeds at the outer edges that are expanding at this point in time? Number two, how does this discovery compare to the recent Higgs discovery from last year?
Two biggies. Go ahead, Mark Drodden.
The first question, I'm not 100% certain what you meant, but let me try to say a little bit about what the expansion during inflation looks like. So the big difference, you might think it's just the speed of expansion that matters. And I should say this, faster than the speed of light expansion thing is one of the things that gets us into a lot of trouble, because people have always been told you can't go faster than the speed of light. So I should say that there's no worry about that here. When this expansion is so fast, it just really means that space itself is being created, if you like, at a very quick rate between objects. That's why they move apart. So there's no problem there. The difference between acceleration and normal expansion is that in a normally expanding universe, if you take a couple of points, maybe there's been enough time since the Big Bang for those two points to talk to one another in order to exchange light, for example, or maybe there hasn't. But if you keep waiting, they will eventually talk to one another. In an accelerating universe, one during inflation, sort of the opposite is true. Even points that are now able to exchange light with one another eventually will not be able to. So they get pushed. What we say in cosmology is they get pushed outside each other's horizons. That means they can't exchange information anymore. And so that's the big difference. So on the edge of those things, this thing we call the horizon, that's where if something's further away, you can't exchange information with it. And if it's closer, you can't exchange information with it. But during inflation, those parts that are inside move outside. In terms of how this compares to the Higgs discovery, they're very different things. I think the right view of both of them is that they're not different in the sense that one's particle physics and one's cosmology. For someone like me, they're both things that tell us about the fundamental way the universe works one way or another. And I think this is at least as important as the discovery of the Higgs, if it holds up to be true. So it's that kind of size of discovery.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Here's a basic question. How big is the universe? Do we know?
Well, it's been 13.7 billion years since the universe was born. The couple ways of thinking about this is, how far can I see, and then how far can I account for? And you can see 13.7 billion light years, because that's how long light has had to travel since the beginning of the universe. But since we know the stuff that we're looking at has been expanding since that point, the number that runs through my head is about 55 billion light years number that you can say, okay, we know about this stuff. But as Mark says, the universe is continuing to expand, and so it's getting bigger.
Indeed it is. Let me see what Wade from Hatboro has to say. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Question, if I may. I'll be as quick as I can.
Okay,
a few. When I was a mere Ute, multi-dimensional steady-state universe, saddle-shaped, toroidal-shaped, cusp-shaped, Mobius strip, where if you travel in a straight line, you wind up where you started, and the concept of finite but boundaryless has gone by the boards. Is the universe, space-time, matter, energy, an expanding or inflating sphere? Second, cosmic background radiation. What does or did it radiate from, and is that source still radiating in real time?
All right,
if you could wave a magic wand and observe the universe in real time for a few days, what might we observe and what might we learn?
Okay, Wade, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Is the universe a sphere, Mark Trotton?
To the best of our knowledge, it's not a sphere, but questions like that are always tricky because whether something is a sphere or not a sphere depends on how well you can measure it. So, for example, if I only were to measure things in this room, I would really, can't imagine an experiment I could do that would be good enough to tell me that secretly I'm on the surface of the Earth, which is curved. But if I got an experiment on a big enough scale, I might see the curvature of the Earth. And so this is a question of geometry, as you might guess. We're measuring curves and things like that. And things that measure the geometry of space, actually one of the best things we have is the microwave background radiation. And that tells us that to the best of our knowledge, the universe is not so much like a sphere, but more just like a flat plane. And now, one question you had was slightly different. It was connected to what we might call the topology of the universe, which is a fancy way of saying, as you said, is it finite and closed back on itself or infinite? And it turns out the best way of testing that we know is the microwave radiation too. And this is a complicated thing to do, so I won't go into extreme detail. But it turns out that the tests you can do so far do not show evidence that it is finite in size. But it's worth pointing out that if inflation is correct, and that's a big if inflation is correct, then it should have expanded the observable universe to such immense sizes that you would not expect to see, even if it was finite on the very largest scales, you wouldn't expect to see that in our current observations.
So one way of looking at that is that the way to measure the curvature of the universe is if you had a ruler and you held it out at a certain distance, you could measure the angle that ruler subtends, you know, how big does it appear. And if you keep moving the ruler away and away further and further away, it should subtend a smaller and smaller angle. Well, if the universe is curved, then you get a different angle than you would if it was, say, flat like a piece of paper or you know, like a sphere or like a saddle. And so we've measured that with the furthest away ruler we can do, which is the cosmic wave background. And to the best of our measurements, it looks flat.
Wade, thanks for the call. Let me see what Sean from Camden has to say. Hi, Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. My question was, they said that the waves were more prevalent than they had originally expected and that they were at a higher level. And I was wondering if the gravity from the more of those waves than they thought there were could account for what they thought they needed dark energy to account for, the bending of light that they couldn't explain otherwise. I just wanted to know if the higher waves could account for that.
Well, you're getting a knowing smile from Mark Trotton.
The answer is no, and the answer is that there's sort of two parts to this answer. One is that these waves we think come from the very earliest times in the universe. So we think that their impact on the universe today should be, in terms of how the universe itself expands today, should be essentially irrelevant. But the other answer is that they're also, the amount of energy in these waves should be very low. That's why it's really hard to detect them, actually. And also, and consequently, their impact on galaxies and things like that should be quite low. And so, you know, you build these incredibly sophisticated experiments to test that because they're so weak. And so it's just not possible for them to combine to have such a big effect as causing this late-time acceleration that you're referring to.
Mm. Anything you want to add to that, Mark?
I think that's basically right. We don't really have any evidence to say that this would have had a big impact on pretty much anything that we're seeing. Remember, they're very large-scale things for the formation of structures, and they're just not going to be relevant.
Sean, thanks for the call. Let's see what Dennis from Lansdale has to say. Dennis, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, I just had a question. One of my friends is an atheist, she's also a molecular biologist, but she sees an organizational structure on such a small level that she's starting to think there's an intelligent designer behind it. And I was wondering, on the opposite scale, on the universal scale, if this new evidence is showing any kind of organizational structure, and also the whole discussion about an intelligent designer.
Well, and we've done whole shows, many whole shows, about this notion of intelligent designer. But Mark Devlin, I'd just be curious about your response.
Well, I think that the what we see mostly when we look at the cosmic wave background is what's called a Gaussian random field. We see basically random, and that's good. When we see things which are not random, then that you know doesn't raise a red flag. It says, mm-hmm. That's really cool. Am I seeing something which is affecting what's going on, something which, as you say, could be making it one way or another. And what happens is we look at the cosmic wave background as a whole and we say, hey, look, it's completely random. It fits a theory which is everything just was basically jumbled up and it behaves physically like we expect using physical laws. When you look at the structure of the universe in more current times and how all that stuff from the very beginning evolved to what we see today in the more recent universe, you see basically what you would expect if gravity and the masses of the fundamental particles and neutrinos and dark energy and dark matter were behaving the way that you expect them to behave. They would all collapse to form the stuff you see naturally. When things look like they're not naturally, like they don't conform to the physical laws, and then we have to go back and say, well, did we get something wrong? And generally speaking, we did, and we fix it. And that hasn't really happened yet. So nobody's seen anything which is so like a smoking gun saying this shouldn't have happened. Mm. And everything seems to be fitting. And that's what's so elegant about the whole model.
This sort of organizational structure that created the universe, Mark Trotton.
Yeah, we see a lot of structure and a lot of detailed organization in the laws of nature. And that's actually why we think they're so beautiful and have symmetry. And when we find new structure, that's how we find new things out about our physical laws. I mean, the question of, you know, your friend being an atheist or not is something that's not really a question for sciences. But the specific question you asked as to whether there's evidence in how we, in our observations and our laws of physics for an intelligent designer, the answer is an unequivocal no, just as it is in molecular biology, by the way.
Let me see what it looks like. Mike. Mike from Fairfield, New Jersey has to say. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Very nice discussion.
Thank you.
I just want to know if you thought this discovery will help in understanding dark matter and dark energy in the structure of the universe.
Do you want to take that, Mark Trotton?
It's a great question. It's not, I don't know is the answer. I mean, the way that we understand dark matter is through the way it clumps up into our galaxies. And so understanding better how the first fluctuations in the universe behaved and eventually led to those may help us in some way to understand more about how to understand how galaxies behaved and they're formed and therefore how to pin down the nature of dark matter better. Dark energy is harder. I will say that if the answer to these gravitational waves is inflation, probably it's not going to help us learn too much about dark energy, although I would love to be surprised. And if I write a paper on this in a couple of years, don't hold me to what I'm saying here at all. But one thing worth saying is there are other ideas out there about the way the early universe could have behaved. And you know, it might be they're becoming disfavored now because of this data, or it might not. It's a little too early to tell. But in some of those ideas, the late time acceleration is linked to the early acceleration. And so if we could verify that, then indeed it would tell us something about that. But my best guess is no right now.
What do you think, Mark?
I think that's basically right. I mean, I get asked this question, is the acceleration of the universe now the energy which drives, we haven't talked a lot about the acceleration of the universe, but dark energy is what we believe is driving it. Is that at all related to the inflationary epoch that we see today? And if so, why is it behaving differently? What are we, you know, what's the difference between those two? And I think that this raises those questions. It's not clear to me that this particular measurement is going to help us understand them at all.
I'm curious about when you go back to Chile. I mean, when it's what's
I go back all the time.
I know you do, but wait.
How does that work?
Yeah.
Well, how does it work? Well, we have a telescope that's at 17,000 feet. It observes. In fact, I mine the cosmic wave background for other information, not necessarily B modes. In fact, there's a whole lot you can do with it because you can think of the cosmic wave background as a backdrop to the universe, and everything that's happened since then, those photons have to pass by, and so you. basically say, well, if this is what it looked like at 370,000 years, and all those photons have to travel 13.4 billion light years to get to me, what did they pass by? And it eventually encodes the evolution of structure in our universe, is encoded in those slight deflections and changes that you see in the cosmic microwave background. And we've designed an experiment to look for all of those. And that is just it's a fascinating thing. So there's lots you can learn that's way beyond, or it's just completely perpendicular to what we're doing with the BMO, with these gravitational waves that we're looking at.
And is it chilly because you can just get so high up? I mean, that's one of the advantages?
It's very high. It's one of the driest places on the planet, like we said about Antarctica. Right. So it's got less atmosphere. It's very dry. You can drive to it. You don't have to fly on a military aircraft to get there. We can build a very big telescope mm-hmm. there relatively inexpensively and operate. So it's a great site to operate from.
So, Mark Trotton, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, and as we said, this stuff has to be proved and more experimentation. What will you be looking for, waiting for, anticipating?
Well, I'm going to wait for new data. So that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see the people who did this experiment tell us a little bit more about how they accounted for the errors, which they're going to do soon, and just wait for this new data from other experiments. Meanwhile, I'm going to allow myself to be extremely excited about this as a theorist. So I'm going to think.
Doesn't happen every day, right?
Right, right. I mean, I'm excited most days, but more now than I was yesterday. And I think, we're going to think about the implications for our existing theories. We're going to think about whether we can improve those. We're going to think about how we might make new predictions from those theories for people like Mark to go test. But most of all, I think we're going to speculate about, which is what we're supposed to do as theorists. And then the data will come along and put us in our place a little more, and we'll move on. But this is how theories progress. So I'm going to be excited.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Very interesting as well. Mark Trotton and Mark Devlin, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting us excited about this find. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us here.
You're welcome. Mark Trotton is a professor of physics, also co-director of the Center for Particle Cosmology at the University of Pennsylvania. Mark Devlin is a professor of astronomy and astrophysics, also at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, carry on a conversation on our homepage. Information also about Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, and much, much more. I'm Marty Moskowitz. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. Well, from